So good morning, everyone. Welcome to our June Zazenkai, our all-day sit here at the Village Zendo. And it's my great honor and privilege and ordeal to get to share some, to give the Dharma talk for today. You know, I know we don't like to talk about things being special in Zen, but there is something, I think, quite extraordinary about our all-day sit. This, you know, sitting in the stillness and silence, that it allows something in us to shift. That usual foregrounding we see of ourselves somehow moves, opens, makes space for all the 10,000 things to advance. And when this happens, this opening in the stillness to what is reality, we come into our true estate and become aware, I think, of the immensity of support that is available, that is our life. Which somehow we're not aware of, you see, when we have our busy agendas. I gotta do this, that, this, and it's all about me and what I want or need to accomplish, what I'm grasping. And so the specialness of a space like this, which for, of course, can only come together through the immense labors of others. You know, the good people who took our registration, made sure that we had a cushion to sit on, a clean cushion, a clean zendo, who trained and set up service positions so that the time can be held, the structure supported, that we wouldn't go hungry. Someone has gone shopping, prepared food. And on, you can just keep multiplying the efforts of people that makes it possible for us to come and let go. You see, and to let go of our habitual, contracted, anxious self that is constituted by a round of habits, mechanisms that ensure I will be safe. I will control. I'll be able to optimize the comfort of my environment and keep myself safe. And we become so used to that, those mechanisms, that we forget. We forget that it is not. I'm not running the show. The show is a lot more mysterious and larger and faster than my anxiety would allow me. No. And so getting ourselves to a cushion, to sit on a cushion, is already something in us that says, I am willing to surrender this misguided need for control. That I do have some intimation that there is something else, that I am the child of a larger inheritance. And we need to bow to that bodhicitta mind that has that sense. I've been dipping into this book called The Master and His Emissary. It's quite a magisterial tome, 600 pages, written by this his psychiatrist. Quite, I think, an enlightened being who has been very interested in the brain and the bilateral aspects of the brain. The fact that all mammals have this brain that's divided into the right hemisphere, the left hemisphere. And so his question, the book is a 20-year response to this question he had when he was a medical student, because that's the first thing medical students are introduced to, was why? Why is it that in all mammals, including birds, there is this phenomenon, a right hemisphere and a left hemisphere? And it's true in the 70s that there were all kinds of theories about that, you know, that they each had took care of different functions, that the left brain took care of language, the right pictures, but this is different. Those theories have been proven a little simplistic. But based on birds and animals, what they saw was that the left brain tends to be very focused. So you can imagine it's what allows a thrush to be able to zoom in on a seed among this grit and go get it. But by the same token, there's this capacity to also be aware of the whole, so that to make sure that when it's out about getting its lunch, it's not going to become lunch for somebody else. So both, you see, work in tandem to allow this focus, the zooming in, and at the same time, this awareness of the whole, the context. So the title of the book then, The Master and the Emissary, comes from this legend of a wise ruler whose dominion has grown so large that he trains emissaries to go and take care of affairs in the domains. And so there's this one emissary who gets quite cocky with his own capacities to run things on the ground and says, well, what need do I have of this ruler, he's absent anyway, deposes him and assumes the role himself. And see, but the problem here, well, the writer points out, Ian McIlchrist, is that the left brain is indeed very efficient at grasping and getting. It's very good at ordering, classifying, categorizing, coding. But the problem is it has no awareness of the larger picture. It doesn't know what it doesn't know. And so the broader perspective of the ruler is lost. The right brain, which is able to respond freshly to fresh reality, is present. Is interconnected, has a sense of the whole. And it can, if when they function well, you see, so when it's aware of something freshly arising in the environment, it can hand it over to the left brain, who then goes about classifying it, using it, manipulating it for its own ends, which would be fine, you see, if the left brain said, okay, let's return to your context. But the left brain can, left to its own devices, forget all about the wider, larger context. And this leads to a mechanized universe, you see, with fragmented, discrete entities that feel separated and disconnected. In describing this relationship, McIlchrist says, the right hemisphere, the one that believes but doesn't know, has to depend on the left hemisphere that knows but doesn't believe. And this word believe, so we might say, so believe what? And I think maybe we could use the word trust. It could be interchangeable. So the right hemisphere that, you see, trusts in the whole, the intelligence of the whole, but doesn't know how to language, classify, depends on this intelligence of the left, who has the classifying capacity to name and use, manipulate, but it doesn't trust, you see, in the whole, because it doesn't have that perspective. So, what would a world dominated by the left hemisphere look like? Well, because the left hemisphere craves clarity and certainty, there'd been increasing specialization of knowledge, and technicalizing, because it loves tools. Its world is in the realm of tools, instruments to use, to master the environment. Knowledge gained through experience would be replaced by information, representation, concepts. The world as a whole becomes therefore more virtualized. Again, what's living actuality gives way to representations. Technology flourishes. because of the left hemisphere desire to control, manipulate for its own ends. And it would be accompanied by a vast expansion of bureaucracy, systems of abstraction and control, with a focus on material, the material, at the expense of living systems. Social cohesion and the bonds between person and person, just as importantly, bonds between person and place, would be disrupted because the left brain has these impersonal agendas. Exploitation rather than cooperation is the default, would be the default relationship between members of society. Paranoia, lack of trust, comes to be the pervading expression between individuals in a society or between the government and individuals. So it's sounding pretty 84-ish. And it also probably comes as no surprise to us that meditation is a right brain activity, right brain hemisphere lights up when we meditate. And I thought it kind of interesting as an aside how, you know, there's the explosion of mindfulness, and we can be very hopeful that there is an increasing, while there's an increasing sense of stress and fragmentation, we are all very, very aware of it, then there's a corresponding interest in mindfulness practices. And yet we can see some people, of course, have issues with that, that the mindfulness becomes commercialized and becomes sort of like a tool in the service of greater efficiency, calmness, to be able to actually do better in a world that is fragmenting. So we know, though, that this is not recent, and that this tension, you see, between the part of us that wants to grasp and name and classify and pursue our own agenda, even, you know, and especially within a spiritual practice, and that many of the exchanges between the Zen masters and their students are embodying, aren't they, that tension. The student who comes with something they already know and they want it verified, validated, or they're seeking something, some bon mot that the master will give them so they can enhance their spiritual acumen, if you will, or fortunes. So I thought I would share the exchange that takes place between, and this is late enough, this is in the 17th century in China, with a female Zen master by the name of Ziyong Chenru, and the scholar that comes to visit her. So Ziyong apparently, you know, she was quite formidable. She, after her own awakening and studies, she ended up opening up quite a few convents and monasteries, and it was the emperor. I think her father had connections with the emperor. But the emperor, it was the emperor who gave her this title, Ship of Compassion. And so the scholar traveled a long distance to meet with Master Ziyong Chenru. He entered the hall, and he and Ziyong looked at each other. And then the scholar said, "I've come to visit this ship of compassion, but who would have guessed the ship of compassion would turn out to be nothing but an old crone?" Ziyong gave an earth-shattering roar. "Ah! What is this place? Tell me, is it male? Is it female?" When the scholar couldn't reply, she said to him, "Come closer and I'll tell you." When he was right in front of her, she grabbed him and said, "From the day you left Spirit Mountain, there has been no place to seek. From this day on, mother and son are reunited." The scholar said, "I trust you completely." And bowing to Ziyong, he requested ordination. So he's come with his expectation, hasn't he? He's heard this title, Ship of Compassion. My God, what's that going to look like? This famous person with this great title. That'll be a notch in my belt. And then he finds himself in front of this probably disappointing looking old hag. You know, and again, which of us hasn't been there? We have this idea of what it is that we want. You know, it could be you choose something on the menu because the description sounds delicious. And then when it arrives, it's not exactly what I had in mind. Or, you know, you think of these poor people on the third day of their honeymoon. They think, "Oh, God, this is not the person I thought I was marrying." And on, we could see in each moment, you know, we come to even the Zazen Kai with the thought, "Okay, going to get calm and chill a little." And suddenly the mind is obsessing about something disturbing that has happened, and you can't let go of it. Or we expect to maybe, "Okay, I'll just hit the cushion and sink into samadhi." And instead, grumpiness shows up and won't leave. And so this is it. You know, how can we meet reality on its own terms when we have our own agendas, which often we're not even aware of until we think, "Man, I don't like this. This is not what I ordered up." And so there's always something subtly in there that's, if you will, has its fist closed around some idea, some representation of myself that I want, that I have plans about what I want to realize. So Ziyong's earth-shattering roar, you see, just smashes this guy's conceptions, his classifications, his codifications, his way of saying, you know, "This is what I'm going to get." Clears it all out. And we ourselves know, don't we, in our own lives, how that can happen, an accident. loss of a job, an illness, a back that won't function. The rug is pulled from under us. I'm going, do, 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 boom. What is this place? You see, when I'm thrown into a reality that I don't recognize, I don't know which side is up, which side is down, there's no exit sign, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. And when I don't know, where do I find the ground? You see, because I'm used to my coordinates all the time, being very, very aware, where's the ground, where's the ceiling, and how I orient myself. When that explodes, who am I? What am I? And how can I trust? On the male-female issue, Jennifer Boylan, who's she's a writer or teacher. I know she teaches at one of the Ivy League colleges, and she's a trans woman. And she wrote about this in the Times. She recently went back to what do you call those when they gather together? A reunion. So it was a reunion for the all-boys school that she had gone to before she made the transition. And, you know, she'd had many friends there, obviously, growing up. And she was well-received, but one of her old pals came to her and said, "Listen, Boylan, I don't have any problem with you. It's just that I miss Jim, that guy you used to be. He was my bud. I don't need Jenny. Jim meant a lot to me." And Boylan said, "But the person you miss is still right here." And her friend just gave her a look, as if this could be true only if there was no actual difference between men and women. And Boylan writes, "Well, I thought about having hurt feelings about this exchange. But I knew what it was like to miss the younger version of someone I had loved. I wanted to say, listen, my brother, sometimes I miss the person you used to be, too." So that was interesting how she phrased that. I thought about having hurt feelings. You know, that capacity, you see, to be able to take the perspective, not be, you know? I could do that, but here's the capacity to do something else, to see what it might be like from his perspective. Where is he coming from? And trying to understand that. And then she goes on to wonder if the biggest difference between who she is now and who she was then is less the result of gender than of time. She says, "Is it because I'm female now that I've become more interested in compassion than righteousness? Or is this simply what the years do to you?" So really, isn't this the question? How we relate to hurt, injury, insults to our sense of ourselves, you see, and how we negotiate that terrain when shit happens. This Zen master, Ziyong, she happened to be a great traveler. You know, and even in the 17th century, you can imagine in China, a woman traveling alone wasn't recommended, but she did it. And here she writes a poem about one day she's on pilgrimage and she seeks refuge in a mountain monastery when the evening falls, but she's not admitted to the monastery, so she writes a poem. To travel in search of knowledge is truly a difficult thing. At dusk, I went to a monastery, but wasn't allowed to stay. At midnight, I sat under the elements, my mind one with stillness. So you got to ask what those elements were, you know? It's one word, but you can imagine it could mean rain, wind, cold, certainly dark, fog, who knows? At midnight, I sat under the elements, my mind one with stillness. Over 10,000 li, I have rambled in Rome. It leaves no sour taste. I laugh at these foolish monks who don't see things as I do and mistakenly regard those of my kind to be stupid and dull. The clear breeze and bright moon in the distant wild, the hidden birds carrying blossoms pass the bamboo gates. You know, it's pretty impressive, you know. Would that we could all maintain our composure under these circumstances. But so this is what allows Ziyong to say, you are always home, no matter where you find yourself. Insulted, rejected, abandoned. That's trust. That's belief. And I think we see echoes of that in the recent tragedy of the woman who was raped by the Stanford student, and in her statement that she read to the court, you know, with these horrendous details of how she was raped behind a dumpster by this 20-year-old. And in her eloquence, using language to, you see, let him see and let everyone see the enormity of this crime, the consequences, just what it is, because we're in a culture and where this kind of thing is dismissed. You know, as they say, 1 in 5 young women are raped. And there's a culture of rape that dismisses it. And once one has read this account, you can never more, I think, dismiss and take it lightly. So after she goes through this way of calling him out and really letting him know what the consequences of his actions were. She ends, in this way. You know, Joseph Biden said also, he wrote to her and said that he thought it should be required reading for every man and woman. And I think he is absolutely right, because I think what it also shows us is that clearly that there's a link between the the distortion of that kind of self-locked system that allows somebody, an individual, see, to exploit and use someone so callously and brutally for their own momentary needs, that certainly that level of consciousness you can see applied to the earth itself. You see the rape and pillage and plunder of the earth. And that it's only born from a mentality, again, that cannot understand and appreciate the interconnectedness. And how we are at a point where we're having to take really, really seriously what is it that encourages, allows this level of consciousness to have dominion, have sway. But so here are her words, which I think are coming from a very different place and showing us. She says, to conclude, I want to say thank you to everyone, from the intern who made me oatmeal when I woke up in the hospital that morning, to the deputy who waited beside me, to the nurses who calmed me, to the detective who listened to me and never judged me, to my advocates who stood unwaveringly beside me, to my therapist who taught me to find courage in vulnerability, to my boss for being kind and understanding, to my incredible parents who teach me how to turn pain into strength, to my friends who remind me how to be happy, to my boyfriend who is patient and loving, to my unconquerable sister, who is the other half of my heart, to Alela, my idol, who fought tirelessly and never doubted me. Thank you to everyone involved in the trial for their time and attention. Thank you to girls across the nation that wrote cards to me, to my DA, to give to me. So many strangers who cared for me. Most importantly, thank you to the two men who saved me, who I've yet to meet. I sleep with two bicycles that I drew taped over my bed to remind myself there are heroes in this story, that we are looking out for one another. To have known all of these people, to have felt their protection and love, is something I will never forget. And then she says, and finally, to girls everywhere, I am with you. On nights when you feel alone, I am with you. When people doubt you or dismiss you, I am with you. I fought every day for you. So never stop fighting. I believe you. Lighthouses don't go running all over an island looking for boats to save. They just stand there shining. Although I can't save every boat, I hope that by speaking today, you absorbed a small amount of light, a small knowing that you can't be silenced, a small satisfaction that justice was served, a small assurance that we are getting somewhere, and a big, big knowing that you are important. Unquestionably, you are untouchable, you are beautiful, you are to be valued, respected, undeniably every minute of every day. You are powerful, and nobody can take that away from you. To girls everywhere, I am with you. Thank you. So she is calling out to girls, but here's the thing, is that we need to call out also to that in boys, in men. Girls, you can call it girls, but what is it? It is that quality of open innocence, that trust, that vulnerability, that aliveness in the moment to life because it hasn't yet been shut down, closed, told to be a certain way. And we have to see that that quality has been injured, not just in girls, but in boys too. That that can only flourish and survive, that resilience, you see, when it senses support, safety, the allowance to be vulnerable, to be open, to be trusting. And we have a lot of work. As a society, as a culture, as a world, to make that a reality. In the meantime, this is how we do it. That we sit in the stillness, in the non-doing, and allow ourselves to connect to that open, trusting, not knowing, delicate, sensitive, subtle, vast self that we are. So thank you all for your support in our doing just that together.